Okay, so by now you know the drill. Go ahead and hit play on part 3 now. With this last meeting between Thorn and Baron, I never attempted to put music under this, and the sound design is very minimal. The tension just seems so much higher that way. And I had to be careful here, because this is another scene that was trimmed down. You know, we know things are sort of moving into the final act, and you want to keep the momentum going, but you absolutely need some sort of resolution between these two. But you don't want to detour for too long. One thing I'm not sure that comes across that I want to clarify, the reason that Thorn lets Baron live. When Baron says, "You'd really just let me walk away after all of this," for Thorn, he still thinks Batman is the one killing his men. He still needs someone to take care of that problem for him, and Baron is still his best bet for survival. But I also think the moment he takes away his gun is really important, because it's the master neutering his dog. I think Thorn believes that Baron can stop Batman, but he's going to make it a lot harder for him. He wants him to get hurt. Of course, later, you know, he'll learn that Batman's not the one killing his men, that he's got a much bigger problem, but that's why this scene ends the way it does. As the music starts to build here, I'm reminded that a lot of fan films sometimes get criticized for using existing music. That seems like kind of a funny criticism when you're making a movie that is, it's a character you didn't create. And in most fan films, you're either referencing stories directly from the comic books or often ripping them off word for word. So it just seems, the music seems like kind of a funny thing to single out when the entire premise of what you're doing is sort of unoriginal. This moment where the Tallyman frees the hostages is another one that sometimes gets misread. He intimidates Tim to, sort of find out what his deal is and decides that Tim's telling the truth when he says, we were going after Thorn just like you. When he moves to Rebecca, though, he's not taunting her. And, he doesn't take off the glasses here to frighten her or because he's being sadistic in any way. It's to make her look more like Jennifer. There's definitely a reason that she's the one that he frees. And, Tim and Vincent's stories wind up becoming very similar. So he doesn't see Tim and Rebecca. He sees Vincent and Jennifer. This part where Tim calls Bruce originally happened after Baron grabs him in his apartment. He's in the trunk of the car, the trunk of the Saturn, and he calls Bruce, barely conscious. The reason I moved it is that I needed to break up this scene of the Tallyman freeing them, because it just took forever for them to untie one another. And it was better to cut back to it when, they're already free and they're on their way out. The only thing now is I think it's missing this really important moment where Tim realizes that Rebecca is still alive. I mean, that's a pretty big emotional beat to skip over. And that's, 100% my fault. Renee is a trooper. She was with us from the first day of fight choreography all the way till the last night of shooting. I mean, we shot for something like 30 days over the course of, these 4 months. And one thing that was nice about production stretching out over that span of time was Charlie, Renee, and Harold in particular were three people we just started spending lots of time with. And I just grew to love all these guys so much. And I know that, when we're shooting, I can be sort of introspective and just very much about the task at hand. So I hope they know how much I adore them and how indebted I am to them for all the hard work that they did for us. It was strange after we wrapped not to see them every week. This is actually the one location we didn't have permission to shoot at. We got kicked off this roof and had to come back the next night and finish before we got caught again. I know other filmmakers might be curious. We didn't have permits, but we did have permission. we got in touch with building managers and stuff, because it never hurts to ask. And it's also a matter of just thinking about what you have available to you through your friends or family before you even write the script, and then just, you know, write all that stuff in. The final act here went through a lot of changes. There's much more to Baron and Selena's relationship in the script. He's got this very obvious attraction towards her that only seems to intensify as things get more violent. There's also sort of a competition between them, and at one point it felt like the victory against Baron needed to be hers. But as a lot of those elements were lost, it seemed like more emphasis had to, you know, it had been placed on the inevitable battle between Baron and Batman. And it felt like Batman needed a big moment, too. I'm still not sure we made the right choice, honestly. I think parts of this film could be interpreted as being very misogynistic. And I don't know what to say. That was never the intention, you know, but I don't know. We were all very aware that in this version, Selina needs Batman to save her, and that really, really bothers me. I mean, she does get the upper hand with Baron. It's just a very short-lived victory. There were just too many rewrites on this section of the film. You start to forget what your original intentions were. This should be the other way around. Selina should have saved Batman from Baron. I'll go on record with that. Our not-so-subtle Harvey Dent reference is coming up. The idea here is that Thorne's got this warehouse full of incriminating information on everyone he does business with, or could potentially do business with. I think at one point we were going to find out what was in the box, and then there was a lot of talk that just didn't really go anywhere. It's better as just this sort of throwaway gag. The sound effect here, when he rolls her over and punches her, I think we could have gone further with. I wasn't satisfied with the sounds I was finding online or on sound effects CDs, so I just started making my own. But yeah, this is one that I wish I'd had a little bit more time to work on. It should make you want to look away from the screen, and I'm just not sure that's the case. Also, when Batman shows up and Baron grabs this gun, that's Tim's gun, presumably confiscated when Baron kidnapped him. There was a scene scripted but never shot where Tim finds Baron's body and gets his gun back before heading off to the stairwell. But I don't miss it. I mean, it lessened the impact and the surprise of Tim coming in with his gun drawn. But if you wondered where the gun came from, now you know. And this fight scene here is supposed to feel a little more brutal, sort of like a free-for-all. That's why there's lots of bones cracking and stuff. And, it was kind of a scary scene to shoot, actually. I mean, you know, when these two giants come barreling at you at full speed, you feel like you're actually in some degree of danger. Charlie actually got hurt here. There was one take where Harold forgot that Batman blocks that last punch and went at him full force. Charlie got his finger jammed in. This was the last fight scene we shot, and by the time we got to this one, I think we were much more confident in our approach, and so it took about a quarter of the time that it took to shoot the others. You know, it's the thing I'm most looking forward to, though, on future projects, is developing as, you know, the way I shoot an action scene. I mean, I will freely admit that it needs work. Okay, I realize what happens to Baron here is pretty disgusting. I just felt like after everything he'd done in this film, he really deserved it. It wasn't enough to just knock him out. And Harold sells it really well. Right here, we originally found out how Batman knew where they were. There was something about the GPS signal in Tim's cell phone. But after switching that phone call between Bruce and Tim so that it took place when Tim was conscious and presumably could just tell him, it didn't make sense anymore. And also, if Tim and Selina had been doing surveillance on Thorne and they knew where his hideout was, then Batman would certainly know, too. You know, they weren't going to discover something that the world's greatest detective hadn't already figured out. This was the last scene we shot on the last day of filming. a really bittersweet moment to be one scene away from wrapping up a project that had consumed such a large part of our lives for so long. It was so strange to say goodbye to Charlie and Renee and Harold and Victor. I mean, this was a pretty incredible experience, and it was as rewarding as it was frustrating, so I suppose we'll all always share that bond. And you can see that the Batsuit is just beat to hell here. The logo's all crooked, and the mask just isn't in that great of shape anymore. I hate that zipper. I forgot to mention it till now. That's not how the mask was made. It's just it would not fit over Charlie's head. So it was either put a zipper on the cowl or, you know, Batman doesn't wear a mask. These scissors. Oh, man. We all kept walking past these scissors. They were just sitting right there when we got there, and everyone kept saying, "Chris, did you see these?" And I was like, come on, the tailing man's not going to kill Baron with scissors. But I had a change of heart when I realized that if all of us did that, you know, if that was our first thought, then possibly Vincent would do the same thing. You know, be prepared to kill Baron some other way, and then he sees these things and goes, this would probably hurt even more. And it's all in the sound effects here. I mean, there's no blood at all. It's just a really gruesome sound effect. And again, Harold knows how to sell it. And that was his last scene, appropriately. The last scene that he shot, right there. Speaking of no blood, with Tim pulling Rebecca out of the car here, watching this now, I feel like they both should have some more blood on them. I remember that I was afraid the movie was going to be too graphic, and I restrained myself in places I didn't need to, and, you know, this being one of them. I mean, Dan's performance makes this scene devastating enough, but I wish I hadn't been so cautious when we shot it. This was the third night of shooting all this stuff in the stairwell, and it was rough. This was a rough night. We were all really tired. Tempers were flaring. There was just a lot to do, a lot of coverage to get, and lots of problems. This was a tough space to work in, and I think the plan of attack we'd worked out just fell flat on its face, and nothing was working the way we had expected it to. The scene also went through some pretty big changes in editing. You can read the original version. The script, is also on the website. It was much more about Tim and Batman, but I started cutting it together, and it felt like it needed to be more about Vincent and Batman. And I think this way works a lot better. And even though this was a really difficult night, there was one nice moment before we started shooting where Josh and I were sitting just outside this stairwell going through the script line by line, changing some of the Tailing Man's dialogue, talking about the scene. And it was just really incredible that some of these guys were invested enough in putting all this work into something they weren't even being compensated for. You know, when it's no budget, I'm happy when people show up and just know their lines. And believe me, that's not always the case. But to see so many of these guys going above and beyond that and treating the whole thing with respect and taking it so seriously, that was really gratifying. So one of the things I was trying to get across here was this idea of things moving in cycles. The most obvious example is how Tim and Vincent now have the same origin story, and even though Vincent dies, we imply that the Tailing Man is going to live on. But also how Selina becomes Catwoman again and how things just seem to repeat themselves. Because the whole good and evil thing is, it's just this balancing act, and sometimes the scale maybe tips in favor of one for a little while, but ultimately things just seem to even out, and a victory now means a casualty later, vice versa. And that's where the last narration with the DJ comes into play, where she talks about someone else coming in to take over Thorne's empire and how they have to be ready for whatever is going to rise up and fill this void. And then we move into the epilogue and show that it's his former allies. It's Tim and it's Selina. And they're the start of Gotham's next wave of villains. That piece of plumbing that's in between Batman and Tim, when I was framing this and, you know, looking for the shot. Oh, I settled on that because, again, it was trying to have visually this representation of, you know, a divide, you know, between them. And I don't don't know. It may be too distracting. It calls a little bit too much attention to itself. I don't know if anybody's asked me this, if anybody's wondered why this flashback here isn't as stylized in the same way that the other one is. It's because Jack was telling that story, and it was him remembering it. For Vincent, this is as real as what's happening, you know, right now. There's no distinction. So it seemed too distracting and unnecessary to color correct that flashback in the same way. Felt like it needed to be more seamless. They say good endings are supposed to be surprising, but inevitable. That's tough to do. I tried. I had a screenwriting teacher back in college who told us we should write our endings first to know what we're building towards. I think for certain projects, that's really good advice. But for me, I never write what they call discovery drafts, where you sort of find the story as you go. I always try to have an incredibly detailed treatment first so that there are no surprises or realizing that something doesn't work. I realize this is kind of a downer of an ending, but that was always the idea, that on a surface level, they accomplish what they set out to do. They catch the Tallyman and they stop Thorne, but the price that those victories come with is pretty severe. And I think the Tallyman was just the catalyst for pushing the three leads to a place where, you know, they were each inevitably already headed. And it's sort of frightening how this one tragedy that is inflicted on Vincent spirals into something that all these other people end up getting caught up in and affected by. And, you know, so of course the violence is cyclical too, or maybe exponential is a better way to describe it. Regardless, you know, the consequences are long-lasting and far-reaching. And as we move into the epilogue, I realize we leave a lot of threads hanging. It is not the blatant setup for a sequel that it probably seems like. I just wanted to end the movie with an ellipsis rather than a period. But if it makes people start, you know, daydreaming or theorizing about, you know, where all this might go from here, that's okay too. My friend Donna is the one who recorded. She's the voice of this DJ. She was in the beginning too. This was the very last thing we did. After I think the whole rest of the film had been cut together, we did this. And it winds up next to, you know, it dissolves into Tim sitting in his apartment, and that was the first day of shooting again. So the fact that they wound up next to each other is kind of funny. Originally, Tim picks up the Tallyman mask in the stairwell after Batman leaves, and that's where there's this moment of ambiguity over whether or not he's taking up the mantle. That was shot in case I chickened out of doing something more definitive. There was also a scene of Bruce picking up Tim for Rebecca's funeral that was supposed to go right here. And, you know, Charlie and Dan were great in it. I just didn't want there to be any closure between those two, especially with the way Tim's storyline wraps up now. This was always the way I really wanted to end the movie. I wasn't sure if people were going to like the idea of Tim being a bad guy, but then again, you know, I don't think the Tallyman is a bad guy, and I think after we see what he's been through, what he loses, and we take that journey with him, it's a little bit easier to understand why things would build towards this. So, but this was sort of a top secret ending, you know, no one other than Kristen and myself knew about it. So that's actually me, and not Dan, for this one scene. If you've watched the blooper reel, you already know that, because even something as simple as this, you know, took me 15 takes to do. On the stuff with Batman on the roof, you can't see it, you know, but there's an apartment building just to the right, you know, just out of frame, and there was this couple sitting in there watching TV. They couldn't see us or any of our equipment. They just looked up, and there's Batman. So they started freaking out, and, you know, she was on the phone with somebody, and he was taking pictures, and Charlie just waved at him. there's also originally an ending narration here, but once the one in the beginning, you know, with the montage got cut, well, the one at the end didn't make sense anymore. It would have felt really out of place. And honestly, I thought it was stronger without it. It was one of the easiest decisions to make, to just scrap it. I think Renee's expressive enough and that you totally understand what's happening here. So as all this wraps up, I just want to try and include some final thoughts here. You know, the thing about making a Batman movie, or, you know, any character that has an established fan base, is everyone's going to have their own ideas about who this character is and what he's all about. And, you know, of course, everybody thinks they're right. And so I know that, you know, there are people that are going to watch this that aren't going to agree with my take on the character, or aren't going to, you know, they're just not going to like my whole approach to everything. And that's totally cool, man. I understand that. And I actually think it's really sort of awesome that, you know, this one character, you know, we all have this definition of him that we're so passionate about and so invested in that, you know, it gets such a rise out of us. I think that's really cool. And, you know, as far as fan films in general, it's just this really sort of amazing subculture. You know, the first movies I made were, you know, Batman movies and, you know, my parents' basement when I was in junior high. So I get a kick out of watching all the stuff that these kids are doing and seeing so much potential in some of it, and just, you know, being really excited for them, you know, because just doing stuff that is so far beyond anything I was doing at their age. And the only real downside to the whole fan film community is that sometimes it doesn't really feel like a community. It seems like there's always a few guys that are more interested in turning everything into a competition, or, you know, proving that their movie is better than yours. And I don't understand that. I think there's more than enough room for all these movies, and we should just let people enjoy them for what they are, and, you know, maybe spend more time, you know, supporting each other, helping each other out, learning from our mistakes. And, you know, on that note, if there's any questions you still have that I haven't answered here, or anything you're curious about, you know, there's, please let us know. There's a message board on our site. My email's up there. Feel free to get in touch with us. And I guess that's it. So thank you so much for watching. I hope I held your interest. I hope this was slightly entertaining. And yeah, we'll see you next time.